Hello and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. I'm here with a special guest in studio, the one and only Alex Thomas. Give it up for Alex Thomas.
Hey there, everyone.
We don't have an in-studio audience, so that's why there was nobody giving it up for Alex Thomas, but here we are. So, Alex, you own guns, is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me. I've noticed that there's quite a strong reaction when you post stuff about guns on Facebook.
Yeah, I've been noticing that too with your posts. It's gets my blood pressure up a little bit.
So. Yeah, I understand. So I appreciate... Go ahead.
Not your post, but the comment thread does.
Yeah. So. Well, my post gets my blood pressure up too, so I understand. So anyways, Abby, which is Alex's wife, texted me a couple days ago and said, like, my husband would be willing to talk to you. Alex, you are a med student, is that right?
Yes, currently in third year.
Third year. So you're in the busy year. Well, sometimes busy year, I should say.
Right now it's not, thankfully.
Yeah, that's why you're able to talk with me. And then you obviously identify as Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a member of the Church of Paradox.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just start with, you grew up with guns, or is the gun thing a new thing for you?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of both in the sense that on my dad's side, my grandparents are from Michigan. You know, grew up in Berrien Springs. My grandpa went hunting a lot as a kid. He owned lots of guns. So whenever I was a kid and would go visit them in Michigan, we'd, you know, do some target practice with a little .22 rifle, and, you know, he's big on teaching, you know, gun safety. And so kind of grew up visiting them and kind of associating, you know, guns with like being in the woods and with grandparents. And so when they moved to San Diego, they actually gifted us their guns. And so there's actually quite a few. But they're all older, so that's the thing too. So they're not. So I would say I'm not the best example of like a, assault rifle owning,
Jesus, Second Amendment Jesus person. Loving, like, yeah. God gave me this gun kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So your grandparents moved from Michigan to San Diego.
Yeah.
And then gave you their guns. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is while you were still living in Michigan.
They were in Michigan and we were in Washington State.
Oh, okay. Got it. Yeah.
So Washington State's gun laws are a lot more relaxed compared to California.
Yeah. So. Yes. So you grew up around the guns then in Michigan. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then you live in Washington State and you have guns there.
Yeah.
But have you ever purchased a gun then?
Yeah. So that's also a thing where it's also kind of a new thing. So we got those guns from my grandparents like 5 or 6 years ago. But kind of after that and where I was actually able to use them more regularly, and kind of get more familiar with, you know, gun safety and how to use a gun properly, I actually looked into getting a concealed carry permit and currently have a permit in Washington for a Glock 23. And part of that was just an academic exercise to see how easy it was to get a permit. And it's very, very easy.
For science.
Yeah.
How easy is it to get a concealed permit? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, concealed carry. So I can carry a handgun in Washington State just with the background check.
And what is a background check like for those of us that don't know?
Just submit the paperwork to the sheriff's office and it goes through the system and they send you your permit later.
How long does that take?
I honestly can't remember, but it wasn't more than 4 weeks, okay. 6 weeks. So it was pretty short.
Okay. And is that for all guns in Washington or is that just for concealed carry permit?
That's from my understanding. Again, that's just for concealed carry for handguns.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you moved down to California. Are all your guns in Washington still?
So all of the long guns are, it's a little bit unclear about California regulations for an out of state resident who has guns.
Oh, interesting.
I tried to register, but I couldn't figure it out. That would become a California resident, which costs a lot of money at this point. So,
okay. So you're a Washington resident. That's just here for school, obviously.
Yeah.
And you're trying to figure out what the gun laws are.
Yeah.
All right. Now, so when it comes to gun regulation, we obviously hear a lot politically about politicians who argue vehemently against any kind of gun regulation. Do you consider yourself one of those people? Like when you hear about people arguing against gun regulation, you say, yes, that's how I feel. Like we shouldn't change anything about the gun laws. Or do you feel like America's gun situation needs some fixing?
It needs a lot of fixing.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Like how so? What changes do you see are needed as a Christian gun owner?
So right now it is, I mean, just looking at the data, and that's all we can really look at, even though that is difficult because research is restricted on firearm usage and deaths in the U.S. That's through the CDC and their budget, by the way. It's like a congressional law.
What is the CDC?
So the Center of Disease Control is not allowed to put money into researching gun violence in a lot of different ways. Or they're heavily restricted into it.
I have heard of that. Okay. So that's the CDC in Atlanta. Is that right?
Yes.
And they can't do any kind of research?
Like public health kind of research.
Yeah.
But there's still data as far as, you know, crime rates are concerned. And there's just a lot of gun deaths. And I think that when you compare to other countries that have a decreased, you know, gun death rate, that, I mean, that's a clear problem that can be fixed and should be fixed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I think I just posted an article online, but just on Black Friday, we're 4%. America is 4% of the world's population, and we own over 40% of the guns. And then on Black Friday, we requested like, I think it was 200,000 permits for the first time in a day for guns. And as somebody pointed out, I don't think it was the Washington Post. I think it was somebody else pointed out that's enough to arm the entire Marine Corps.
Yeah.
And you're like, what is happening here? So you don't view that as like, that's okay. Is that right? Or do you view that like, well, that's okay, you know, people just buy guns or whatever?
So I have a lot of mixed feelings on a lot of different topics, and this is kind of one of them, because in the sense where I own guns and I know how I use them, and I know that I use them responsibly, and, you know, it is frustrating to me when I have barriers in whatever hobbies I'm pursuing. Mm-hmm. And so I understand that frustration. And however, I do think that there is a common sense kind of line. I know that sounds like a kind of talking point, and that's kind of undefined vocabulary, so I probably shouldn't use that. Maybe you should repeat the question.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So we've got this population of America. 4% of the world's population is America's gun owner. Now I screwed up. 4% of the world's population is in America, right? And we own over 40% of the guns. We just on Friday bought 200,000 more guns, which is more than enough to arm the entire Marine Corps. Is that something that you just view as like, okay, that's the Second Amendment and that's totally fine? Or do you think that we have enough guns and we should start looking at maybe we should slow down the amount of guns that we're producing, essentially?
Yeah. So I don't know if the volume of guns per se matters so much in my opinion. So I guess when I kind of how many guns I have access to, there's the handgun that I currently own, but then there's also a 30-06 deer rifle, three different shotguns, 16 gauge for bird hunting, 22 rifle, 22 pistol, and a 410 shotgun. Mm-hmm. So that's, I might have lost count, 8 or 9 guns.
8 or 9, yeah.
That I personally have access to.
Yeah.
And so while that's a high volume, you know, those are all guns from the 30s and 40s. They're all really old. They're specifically designed for a hunting purpose, not for killing as efficiently as possible, which a lot of guns currently sold in the U.S. are designed for.
And there's none of those are automatic weapons, are they?
No.
Right?
Two of the shotguns are semi-automatic, but they only can hold 5 cartridges, I guess.
And semi-automatic means what versus automatic?
So pull the trigger, shoots one cartridge, you have to release the trigger, resets, and then you pull the trigger again.
Okay. So you have to pull the trigger for each shot, essentially.
For each shot, yeah.
Okay. So what then... You sounds like you have a line there with like you won't own an automatic weapon. Is that right? Or is that just because it's expensive? Like this is all stuff that I'm learning.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that it's obscenely expensive. So as a Christian, I feel like it's a very poor stewardship of me to spend my money on something, you know, that's just fun to shoot for a few minutes. Like it is a lot of fun. I have shot weapons in ways that you aren't allowed to shoot at firing ranges. It is a lot of fun, but it's also very expensive. And there's no point to it really besides it just, I don't know. It's fun. It's like in the sense of like lighting things on fire or kind of exploding things. I don't know. It's along the same vein.
Yeah, I understand that. So, but it's expensive. You said like how expensive is it?
So again, I don't own any assault rifles, but to buy rifle cartridges, I mean, they're 75 cents to $1 per round. And so if you're shooting like a 30-round magazine,
it costs $30.
Yeah. And so for me to go to the range right now in California with my handgun, just the ammo alone would be $50. For each time I went, if it was just shooting, you know, 100 rounds, which isn't that much. And that's just prohibitively expensive for me right now.
Yeah.
And I get what it's in for most people. So.
Yeah.
It's just not the most responsible usage. Although it is responsible if you're saying that, you know, you need to practice, which I understand because you need to be practicing, you know.
Yeah, you don't want to be shooting an automatic weapon for the first time out around a people, I would assume.
Yeah.
Okay. So when it comes to the Second Amendment, is this like something that you view it's more for defense of your home, or do you view it more as like your right to own guns is something that's more of a sport kind of thing? Or do you view it more as there's one other one, marksmanship? Well, I guess that's sport also. But like when it comes to the Second Amendment, is it more for your personal defense? Are you worried the government is going to come and take your guns?
No, or... I'm not worried about that.
You're not worried about it. Okay. What is it that you view then when it comes to like the Second Amendment?
So I guess just historically and academically speaking, my understanding of the Second Amendment was to allow the citizens to prevent any sort of governmental tyranny from infringing on their rights. That's my understanding. And that might just be kind of a cultural message that's been propagated, but that's, I don't know, that's how I see the function of the Second Amendment back in the 1700s.
Yeah.
Looking at this now, no matter how many automatic rifles I own, even if they were legalized, you know, I can't do anything against the U.S. military. You know,
yeah, be,
drones,
that would be difficult.
Airstrikes.
It seems like.
You know, there's a lot of practicalities now that me owning a firearm will not protect my liberty compared to back in 1700s when the Constitution was written.
Yeah.
So I think that argument is a bit of a misnomer just because the context has changed so much.
Yeah.
As far as sportsmanship goes, you know, I don't think I have a right to engage in any sort of sport. So that's kind of more on the privilege end of things, I would think, that I have the opportunity to engage in a sport, whether it's hunting or target okay. shooting, just like I have the opportunity to participate in skiing or hiking.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. That's why I think the Constitution, in my mind, the purpose of it is more or less not relevant at this point, which I'm sure people will disagree with.
Well, I mean, that's especially surprising coming from a gun owner. And one thing that I've been impressed with is that when it comes to gun owners in particular, it seems like there is this understanding, this stereotype, really, that gun owners are all one certain way. But I hear you saying something about the Second Amendment. I haven't heard many gun owners say, it feels like.
So some context for this little bit of a joke that I'm not going to tell very well, but I went to a very liberal school, and so my icebreaker for a lot of, you know, like group things was, for two truths and a lie, was that I'm a Republican, gun owner, and evangelical Christian. And the lie was that I'm Republican. I actually vote Democrat. So I definitely don't really fit the mold that you classically see of a gun owner. So there is that.
Well, and this is, so when I was in Montana, I remember I got mailers from the people running for Congress. I think it was for the Senate, actually. And what was interesting was I got the Republican mailer first, and it had a guy on the front, whoever was running for the Senate. And on that picture in Montana was him holding the biggest rifle they could possibly find, I'm convinced, right? And I'm like, well, of course, that's what Republicans are, right? 2 days later, I got the Democrat mailer in Montana, and the picture that's on the front is of this candidate holding the biggest rifle he possibly can as well. And it's like, there's this very clear message that's being sent to Montanans, which is, we are not going to fight. We are so pro-gun. We're on your side with this thing. And there was this fear. And I understand that owning a gun in Montana is way different than owning it in California. Just like I assume it's different in Washington than it is California.
Yeah.
It's a different world. And I understand that. But at the same time, it's funny how people often put those together or lump those together. And it's just not the same outside of California.
Yeah. And my understanding is that kind of the fear of the government taking away guns is a symptom of a larger kind of, not psychology, what's the philosophy? There we go. That's the word. Kind of a larger philosophy of kind of anti, you know, federal government, large government mentality.
Mm-hmm. All right. So when it comes to gun regulation, then, as a Christian evangelical Democrat, that owns guns, right?
Yeah.
What would you do? Like, what would be the first step that you would do if somebody asked you to be in charge of gun control within America?
The first step would be research.
Okay.
I mean, just as a medical professional, I think it's idiotic that there is no research funded in a public health setting mm-hmm. going against what is really a public health issue.
Okay.
So that's a really easy one that I feel like anyone can agree on.
Yeah,
I don't see any reason why you wouldn't agree on it.
Yeah.
And to me, the reason why you wouldn't agree on it is if you assume it will show something that you don't want people to know.
Yes, that's well said.
So to me, that means that, you know, that's really the first step.
Okay.
And, you know, aside from that, I honestly wouldn't know. I'd want to talk to experts about different things that have worked in different settings. So like gun control laws in Chicago should be different from gun control laws here in Netherlands, should be different from gun control laws in Montana.
Okay.
So that's a lot of the state regulation. But also when you look at, I mean, because I remember you talking about Chicago in the last podcast, for example, how that's mm-hmm. a prime example
yes.
the lot of Republicans cite as far as gun laws and the lack of success.
Yeah.
So the huge misnomer there is that the U.S. doesn't really have closed borders, and so guns can come from other states and other cities, like full in Chicago, because there is a demand in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And so the gun laws in Chicago might make those guns illegal, but it doesn't necessarily negate the access to those guns.
Okay, yeah.
And so it does seem like access to firearms is one of the root issues, at least in that urban setting.
Yeah, yeah. So do you believe that if there were more guns in the United States and more people had guns, we'd be a safer nation?
No.
No, why not?
I don't believe that. So the only way that I've personally can, like, I guess emotionally or kind of intellectually understand it in my own context is that if I have a toy or if I have a new item or I have a new capacity, you know, for action through like what a piece of gear I have, I'm going to want to use it. For me personally, I'm going to own something because I want to use it for a purpose. And so if I have that thing, I'm more likely to use it for that purpose, obviously. But I think also, specifically in the context of owning a weapon, it opens up a whole new option of possibilities as far as confrontation and action goes when you are in the setting where you do feel threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think on one hand, if no one had guns, then, I mean, there's still going to be violence and there's still going to be people that use other weapons instead of that. But with guns, it just means that the violence is more accentuated, I guess.
Yes.
Or highlighted. And it's a much faster way to kill someone than with, you know, a knife or baseball bat. So.
And what's interesting is when I found that I say things like that are anti-firearms, people immediately assume that I think that there will be this perfect utopia within humanity and that there will not be any more violence. And I'm always like, no, come on. I never said like a knife can't kill somebody or a truck can't kill somebody. But there's just the immediate assumption that that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's like, yeah, there's still violence that will happen, but when you have an AR-15, you're able to do a lot more violence in a much shorter time than even if you had a musket from the 18th century.
Yeah. Or my old shotguns, even the semi-automatic ones, they jam if you pull the trigger too fast.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
again, this is why I might be a little bit biased, but the guns I have are not effective for any sort of except for the handgun, I guess, for any sort of self-defense or offensive measure.
Yeah. Now, I've noticed that you've also referred to guns as weapons.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate because I've noticed that a lot of people have referred to them as tools. And I don't know, that's hard for me to get my head around because a tool for a hammer, I mean, you could say that a hammer is designed for deconstruction. But it feels so different to me, and I kind of scratch my head, and I'm trying to learn here. I scratch my head when people refer to it as a tool.
Yeah.
Why do you refer to it as a weapon and not a tool?
So I go both ways on the semantics of that, because the words we use are important.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this conversation, I've been talking about a weapon because we've been talking about it as a gun as an application of force against a living being. Mm-hmm. Specifically humans. We haven't talked about hunting yet, but it's a more similar idea, where that is its primary focus, its primary purpose and design. I do think, however, you could say that it is a tool in certain settings. However, it's very fluid in that identity between a weapon and a tool.
Okay. What would be some settings where it was a tool?
So for me, I actually have gone hunting. So I think hunting is kind of a gray area between a tool and a weapon.
Uh-huh.
For me personally. So I don't go sport hunting. Any hunting I do, I would want to eat whatever I've shot and killed.
Okay.
So that's been, I'm not that most successful. So it hasn't been that, hasn't been like I'm feeding, you know, the family or anything. But
yeah,
for me, in that sense, I'm using it for a practical application in a way that connects me more to nature and conservation. It makes me more aware of how even like something as simple as my diet impacts the world around me.
Yeah.
And so to me, the gun then turns into a tool because it's teaching me about my place in the world, as opposed to it be primarily being a way for me to kill something or someone.
Okay. See, I can understand that when people refer to it as a tool, if they're going to eat the food, like if they eat the food of the animal they killed, right? I get that. And in my opinion, that is actually more humane to me than a slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
And I'm a vegetarian, so I'm just going to own that like up front. But the fact that you have to see the life and interact with the life in order to eat, like, I don't think that's evil. I actually think that's more reverent, and obviously you can find cases of both on either side.
Yeah.
But I could see how somebody could say, like, I respect the life of the animal more when I hunt it than a slaughterhouse where it enters this anonymous box that society hides and then processed meat comes out later.
I completely agree. I think it, the fact that, at least for me morally, you know, for the reason I'm not currently a vegan or anything like that, is that I feel like I have to be able to interface with each type of food I eat. And since I mean, I wouldn't say I'm okay with killing an animal to eat it, because it isn't, for me, it has always been an emotional experience still.
Yeah.
Like, it is really serious to see, I don't know, something give its life so you can just have a different type of meal. I don't know. It's a really deep experience, and I actually think it's, I don't know, really special in a way to interact with God's creation. But you definitely need to have the mindset of, you know, being really thankful and appreciative of, you know, where this came from. And, you know, I just think that I've learned a lot as far as kind of understanding, yeah, I guess my own impact on mm-hmm. the world around me, and seeing like the chicken I buy at the store, you know, I obviously didn't hunt that chicken down.
Yeah.
But I can still understand the, like, quote unquote sacrifice or, you know, the strain on the ecosystem that
Vegan
meat eater
is. Yeah. So. And I understand that. And once again, I've been going through my family tree recently, and I'm sure that it was only recently that we became vegetarian. And before that, I understand. And, you know, you had to live that way. And I would call a bow and arrow a tool in that situation if they were hunting. Once again, I think that you drew a line between hunting for food and hunting for sport.
Yeah.
And I feel the same way, where like, okay, like I can see the big difference there. I can also understand hunting for population control within a society. I understand that. I don't think it's cruel, and it's how a society functions. One question I was going to ask you is, when you kill an animal for food, I assume that you have to get a license.
Yes. Actually, I learned a lot getting that license too, besides just like the factual bits about hunting. But one thing I didn't realize, you know, being a liberal school, is that hunters are huge conservationists.
Yeah.
In that sense, they also kind of move away from that classic stereotype of, you know, this is, you know, private land, I own my gun, you know, this is, I'm free to do whatever I want with it. They actually, a lot of hunters are in favor of hunting regulations, gun control, because it does protect, you know, the mm-hmm. habitat and wildlife that they, you know, have their hobby in, whether it is hunting for food or for sport.
Yeah.
So something I thought was really interesting is that there's a lot of people who are more conservative than I am that actually are very progressive in the way that they want to go about land regulation and conservation.
Yeah. And that's a huge difference that I also don't hear spoken about that often when it comes to the gun and the difference between hunting for sport and hunting for that, because there's obviously a huge difference between those people that are going through and getting the permits and making sure that the population doesn't go out of control and it's part of helping the government, and somebody who goes to Africa and wants to get like different. The big five and they hunt these animals that are sitting ducks so they can take a picture. It's a whole different thing. And, you know, obviously there's a big difference in the Facebook reaction to both of those things.
Yeah.
So, excellent. So when you go, so you have a few guns that are from the 30s and 40s, and then one gun that's a recent gun. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I think one question that I have for you is, when you bought that more recent gun,
mm-hmm.
did you view that as a spiritual decision at all?
So at the time, no. But then that was before I was married. And so when I got married, the conversation came in, you know, am I allowed to keep this thing?
Oh, yeah.
And so that's when I really started to discuss, you know, the more theological and kind of moral issues of keeping a handgun, specifically a modern handgun whose purpose is designed for, you know, it's compact, it's meant to be carried easily and used for self-defense. Like, that's the primary purpose. It's not used for hunting.
Yeah.
Like, there's no argument that it's can be used as a tool.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that there is no theological argument for owning a handgun.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is where it's a little bit tough for me. Yeah, I mean, I just, this is where I get more gray area, more conflict, because in my mind, there are more theologic cons to owning a handgun, I mean, than there aren't any pros. So there's no condonement of owning something like a handgun. You know, again, it costs money, it's poor stewardship. And also, like, I remember you talking about in the previous podcast that in one way, it's also putting more faith in your own actorship as opposed to God protecting you. And that's kind of an interesting thought with self-defense with firearms too.
Yeah.
But then again, the way that I've kind of reconciled having the handgun is that, again, I guess similar to my experience with hunting, it has taught me important things. So responsibility with an object that is potentially lethal, and handling an object, you know, that otherwise would be to me a black box. And so I personally would rather know how to go about something safely as opposed to not knowing about anything at all.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, that's not a theological argument, but.
Well, but I can understand that, especially given the overwhelming presence of firearms within America today. I mean, the chances are you will interact with some at some point. And I'll tell you, I would have no idea what to do in a good or bad situation with that. So I can understand that. Yeah. And even when I talk to the three Christian gun owners, the thing that, when I talk to them about a spiritual decision to own a gun, the thing that they said is they talked about how the world was evil, and they even alluded to the fact that they didn't like owning the gun for protection. Like that wasn't something they viewed like was a long-term solution, but just living in the middle of an evil world, this was one way that they felt they were able to maintain a sense of safety and security in that. And once again, that was something that I hadn't heard much of before. And I was like, okay, I can understand that.
Yeah. And there definitely is a sense of safety and security when you are carrying a firearm. I won't deny that.
That's so counterintuitive to me, because I'd be like, oh my gosh, there's a gun in my pocket. There's a gun in my pocket. Oh my gosh. Well, if it's in my pocket, obviously I don't know what I'm doing, right? There's a gun on my hip. I'd be freaking out, but that's me. So,
I mean, part of that too might just be, you know, my heteronormative, like masculine, narrative that's been told to me that, you know, carrying a gun's cool.
Yeah.
But I honestly hope that I will never, ever use a firearm. I pray that I never use a firearm against another human being.
Yeah.
And that would not be my go-to. I know that's easy for me to say now, where I'm sitting in a comfortable room of Paradox headquarters with you right now, where I'm not currently under any threat.
Yeah.
But my hope would be that I could follow the example of Jesus and be more self-sacrificial, as opposed to being, I don't know, more offensive in the way I would approach a confrontational situation.
Yeah.
And so I know it's really easy to go into hypothetical scenarios where I would possibly need to use a gun, but I don't know how helpful that is, because those scenarios aren't, I mean, prevalent or necessarily that realistic in a lot of ways. And I don't think that you can argue the purpose of having something by using the most extreme example in which you would use it.
Oh, that's well, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good way to say it. I feel the same way, where I love to preach about nonviolence, but I haven't really been under threat from somebody who has a weapon that's better than mine.
Yeah.
Personally, we're not talking about globally, because that's a whole different issue right now. But when it comes to personally, I've never had somebody holding a weapon to me that gave them a distinct advantage. And I can tell you that when I was facing that moment, I chose not to act in violence or act with a weapon. I'd love to tell you that I wouldn't, but I don't know. And to pretend that I do know, I think is a bit of a big talk without having a lot of experience.
I feel the same way.
Yeah. And it's different. It's different when you read other people that have gone through it. Like, you know, Gandhi is one person who's spoken to me a lot when it comes to nonviolence, not so much on some other things.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Luther King Jr. is the same way, where they've gone through it and they've trusted it. And their life has been inspiring because of it. But I don't know if I would have quite the amount of faith that they had, because that seems like it's a very daunting and challenging thing.
Yeah. And then possibly the more sticky question for me is, how would I use a gun in defense of someone else? So if you can imagine your family or your kids or even your neighbor, you know, that's where I feel like I would have no right to not defend someone, because it's their life, not mine, that I would have the decision, you know, to engage with nonviolence in, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
But then again, you're also engaging in the act of, you know, trying to kill someone with a handgun that, I don't know, that still to me is a huge kind of cognitive dissonance for me.
Yeah.
That, you know, I don't think that you can really know how you approach it until it's there.
So. Yeah. And I mean, hopefully it won't, obviously. Yeah. But it's just one of those things where I look at it and I'm like, I don't think I would do that. And that's what I would hope I wouldn't do. But ultimately, I don't know, because I haven't been in that extreme of situation.
Yeah.
And when Martin Luther King, like, has his house bombed multiple times and it's tapped and all this stuff, and I can't imagine what it's like not having any kind of security in life. The fact that he just continually refused to go that way is what, you know, it's one of those things that you just hope and strive for me personally. But I don't know. I don't know. And anytime somebody does tell me about nonviolence, I'm always like, so tell me about when you've had to really make a choice. And if they're like, well, you know, every day I'd be like, well, you're still in the same boat as me. It's fine.
It's like, I didn't flip this one guy off when he cut me off on the highway today.
Yeah, you know, so I know. That's, you know, I know. That's a whole different story. Let me ask you another question.
Yeah.
So did your wife grow up with guns in the house?
She did not. She was adamant against me bringing down a firearm to California.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I'm not trying to get you to like share stuff that you shouldn't share, but was there something that kind of helped that discussion or moved it along?
I mean, I think it was similar things that we've been talking about, as far as my own personal reasons for kind of thinking why it's okay for me to have a firearm in my household. That competition might change when we have kids, however, given that there are inherent safety risks to having a firearm in your house, no matter how locked it up it is. Yeah. No matter how hidden it is from kids, there's still an inherent risk. And I do think, however, that once you kind of get through the gap of, you know, when they're really young to when they're a little bit older to understand that, I do personally think that firearm training is important for kids because even if I don't have guns, their friends, family might.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think it's one of those things similar to alcohol or drugs or even sex where it's better to educate and be aware of, you know, safe ways of going about things as opposed to just ignoring it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because when you're talking like that, you remind me immediately of my grandfather who had the same kind of philosophy. He grew up in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And in Minnesota, he had the sense that every boy should know how to shoot a gun and know what a gun was and gun safety. And my grandmother hated it. Like, the only time I saw them argue, and he passed away when I was 10,
mm-hmm.
the only time I saw them argue was over him teaching me how to shoot a gun.
Yeah.
And she was just like, I don't like it, Roland. I don't like it at all. And he just kept saying, like, every boy needs to know how to shoot a gun.
Yeah.
And it was the only time I saw them disagree. And he had the same philosophy, which was everyone, the more that you talk about it and make it accessible, the more you take away the mysterious nature of it.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's what he was really trying to teach us. And, you know, I was 10 years old and I was like, oh, cool, a gun. So...
And I think kind of going along those lines as well, in a similar way that if you kind of demystify things, it makes it easier for people to talk about. And kind of following that down the line, I would think it'd be easier for us to have a national conversation about gun legislation and gun control in ways that are smart, but still, I mean, I guess it's impossible, but make everyone happy
mm-hmm.
in the sense that, you know, we're safe, but also people who feel like guns are very important to them still have don't feel like they have their rights infringed.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. So when it comes to mass shootings, and there are several issues involved,
yeah.
I assume that you think that something can be done to fix this and make it so that these happen with less frequency.
Yeah.
What are some things that you think need to change in order to prevent these things from happening?
So I hear very mixed things from different sources that I read. As far as more progressive legislation issues, as far as on the legal side anyway, as far as background checks and registration and kind of monitoring who buys guns and what kind of guns you can buy, that's then kind of thrown back that those don't work, that those wouldn't have stopped any of the mass shooters. And I don't whether know that's true or not.
Because we can't research it.
You can't research it.
That's why.
And even if you are applying them to specific cases, I don't know, I feel like you can always find exceptions to where whatever a legislation agenda is, it wouldn't apply to whatever you're trying to fix. And I do think that there are some more conservative legislative things I've heard of that would make more sense. So they talk about strengthening the, what's the government body that the ex-Air Force guy, when he was discharged, he should have filed through this government.
Oh,
it's like
yeah.
CID something.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I can't remember the acronym.
But
called.
Yeah, what you're talking about is when the Air Force knew that it was the Las Vegas guy or the Texas guy?
The Texas shooter.
This is tragic that I can't keep them straight. The Texas shooter had a history of domestic violence.
Yeah.
Is that right? With his wife, and the Air Force didn't report it, which would have kept him from getting the gun that he got. Is my understanding. Is that right?
Yeah. And so what I've read from more conservative sources is that kind of bolstering the current system that we have and making sure that there aren't any gaps for people to follow through, that's kind of something that we should pursue
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just creating new barriers.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how I feel which way is better or not, again, because I'm not an expert in the topic, but I feel like, you know, gotta start somewhere.
Well, and this is where I'm at. And I said this during the last podcast, but I think it's important to keep saying, because I found a lot of respect for gun owners that care passionately about mental health,
yeah,
and are willing to say that we need to make drastic changes in the way that this country addresses mental health. And what's interesting is when I've posted things about being anti-firearm, is immediately people assume that I'm pro the current health system toward the mentally ill.
Yeah.
And that could not be further from the truth. And what I found a lot of respect for is when there are gun owners that believe passionately that this can be fixed and that things need to be changed in order to prevent the mentally ill from getting guns, as well as caring for the mentally ill. That's where I find a lot of life, and I wish we could do more as a nation going forward.
Me too. Unfortunately, that kind of conversation snowballs into some ideas that are very antithetical to more conservative political thinking.
Yes.
As far as, you know, if you want better mental health and you better coverage, and you kind of go in the order of how we achieve that. And I personally believe, after seeing all this legislation going through and our experiences, you know, with the Affordable Care Act, that universal health care really is the answer, as far as simplifying things, simplifying costs, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Having more access for people just makes sense. But there's so much baggage with even just saying,
oh my goodness,
the phrase,
yes,
universal health care.
Yes.
Let alone talking about ways that, you know, we can reach that. And so I think there's so many other big picture things that when you tie it to anything, I mean, just there's a lot of hypocrisy. So like what you highlighted before is that, you know, it's kind of hypocritical to say we need better mental health, but we'll take away funding for mental health programs.
Yes.
I think it's the same thing with healthcare, in the sense that if you're against abortion, you should not take away birth control,
yeah,
access.
Yep.
Like those things, you can't have both.
I agree with that 100%.
And
like, I'm all for people having principles. Just, yeah, stick to the principles. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah. Anybody that says that these results are primarily the problem of mental health rather than automatic weapons. Okay, so just make sure that we really take care of the mentally ill,
yeah,
and identify it, and, you know, make sure that these people don't end up with guns.
Yeah.
The abortion birth control one is another one that I feel very passionately about, which is the idea of like, okay, if you're anti-abortion, fine, that's fine, but don't then take away people's access to birth control.
Yeah.
Because then you're creating more of a problem than you are solving one.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where it gets very complicated. Things aren't, you know, existing in their own bubble. They're all interrelated.
Yeah, they are. And I just read an article on Washington Post where they were talking about how we're going more and more toward tribal morality, which, yeah, I thought was a really interesting phrase, because the idea is like our tribe is right more than the idea of what is right.
Yeah.
And the idea is the tribe is identified by certain stances for or against certain things. And that's very dangerous, because if we're convinced that that's it, then you've kind of got to buy the whole package of a political party, rather than saying like, well, you know, I support some things in this party and I support other things in this party.
Yeah.
Which is what more and more, I think, younger people are doing, it seems like.
Yeah. And I personally like living in that gray area. It's more interesting to me,
yeah,
to not have an answer.
Yeah.
And so it really does break my heart when I see, you know, so many of the different moralistic tribes, you know, pairing up, whether it's, you know, your classic quote unquote white evangelical Christian who's more conservative. Like, to me, like, they just shouldn't be broken down. I don't know, because I feel like a lot of Americans, people that live in this country, whether, you know, your race, your socioeconomic background, whatever religion you are, we all have the same goals as far as, you know, living with health, keeping our families safe,
yeah,
and, you know, having opportunity. I think that there's a lot of overlap in those goals, and also a lot of overlap in how we can get to those goals. And I think it does break my heart when there's so much division.
Yeah. Well, it's what's strange too is like, even the things that you figure are not divisive at all end up bringing division, especially, yeah, in this political climate. I remember one time in a sermon I said, Jesus spent his life bringing healthcare to the poor.
Yeah.
And somebody came up afterwards and said, well, it didn't cost Jesus anything, did it? And I'm like, That's the takeaway?
Oh, no. Like,
that's the takeaway? Well, as long as people can pay for it, they get healthcare. Otherwise, you know, it's their problem. And I understand there are lots of complications to healthcare, yeah, that are way above my pay grade when it comes to politically, right?
Same, yeah.
But I'm going to always vote for greater healthcare access over everything, pretty much, because it seems like that is, without a doubt, one of the greatest priorities within the Christian tradition is the idea that the people who are poor receive good health care. Like, it's really hard to argue against that from a Christian perspective, in my opinion.
I agree. And that's really the main thing that keeps me going, is looking at how beautiful the gospel is. And it just gives me a lot of hope in, you know, something that's a goal to be working towards as far as how this world overall should look.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. So a little bit about mental health, a little bit about gun safety, and a little bit about gun background checks. Was there anything else that we needed to touch on as far as like what you think needs to happen within gun control in America here in 2017?
Honestly, nothing. I don't think I have anything else to add to that. I don't have any experience as far as looking at other solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a tough topic. There's a lot of different opinions, lots of different situations. So
why do you think it is that my sense is the majority of gun owners feel the way that you and the other gun owners that I've talked to have. And there's a small group of people that are very powerful and noisy when it comes to political maneuvering and all that stuff that prevent all of these things happening that most gun owners and non-gun owners want.
Yeah.
Do you have any perception as to why that is and what someone like you or me could do about that?
My oversimplified answer for this question, as well as anything regarding to healthcare or really any sort of business, any sort of political issue in this, is that comes down to greed in a lot of ways. Yeah. And so when you have the money incentive pointing the wrong direction, I mean, that's just the way that politics are going to go.
Okay. And is that like from weapons manufacturing, or is it from ammunition, or?
All of the above.
All of the above.
Just because there are a lot of, I mean, it's the same thing in healthcare, like with insurance companies and drug companies. Like there's, in any industry, there's a lot of money to be made. And that's a lot of money that's already being made. And any regulation tends to kind of cut back on that money being made. And so that makes, I don't know, that's a gross overgeneralization, but.
No, I was thinking through in my head because, I mean, so much of what this current administration is just like get rid of all sorts of regulations so we can just make as much money as possible.
Yeah.
That seems to be the consistent theme over and over again. And even I just saw recently where President Trump was talking to some troops overseas and he just wanted to reassure them that the economy was good.
Yeah.
Which was like, is that what we're here for? Like just to have a good economy? Because I don't remember the Constitution reading or the Declaration of Independence say like we hold these truths. I can't keep them straight. The Constitution. I know which one it is.
Yeah.
We hold these truths to be self-evident that we could make money.
Yeah.
Like that's not... It's not our goal, is it? I mean, obviously you want to be taken care of. And as you said, like having protection and healthcare, but that's what's really hard. That's what's really hard about the current political landscape and what's come before, I think.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think it comes down to money when it comes to this political quagmire that we're in, when it comes to the gun control and the stalemate that it's on.
Yeah. I think this will be a fascinating, you know, my college course in, you know, 50 years about talking about how the way, you know, so few voices control so much of the narrative and like the way that social media is constructed and just like a lot of the structures we have in society. I just think it's really, I don't know, interesting to be living in this time.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see here. I'm trying to think if there's anything else looking at my notes. No, I think that's pretty good. We'll go with that.
All right.
Does that sound good?
Nice and short.
All right. I'm gonna give us a better closing than that. So it's not like me going, all right. Unless there's something else you felt like we need to talk about.
Not about guns, no.
Let me ask you this. Is there like a line in your head of what's okay and not okay with gun ownership?
No, and again, I like those gray areas.
Uh-huh.
So something that's more of a line for me living in an urban area in California would be less effective for someone living, again, in the boondocks in Montana. So for example, like if I'm only restricted to have a 10-round magazine in my Glock, you know, that's a bad example. Handguns aren't the right example.
Okay.
I can't have a rifle here in Redlands, right, without having it registered. I can't, you know, shoot at my backyard, anything like that. And that's, that makes sense, right?
Yeah, because you're going to hit somebody.
But if I'm in Montana and I have, you know, bears, cougars, even like mountain goats kill people.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of other dangers out there, hypothetical dangers and real dangers for certain people that laws that would apply for me wouldn't apply for them. So I don't think that there necessarily is a hard line for what kind of caliber or what type of rifle I think there are some common sense things, like you can't have, you know, a magazine that holds 200 rounds and have a fully automatic rifle. That's, to me, is aligned. That's way on one end. As far as where a reasonable line should be, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm going to wimp out on that question.
That's fine. And then one other question I want to ask you. Have you heard churches talk about firearms before?
No.
Never?
Never.
And you've been going to church your whole life, right?
Yeah.
How old are you?
I'm 24.
Did you ever hear about it in like religion class?
No. And I've gone to different religious contexts. I went to Christian school. I went to Jesuit school. I went to Adventist school for a couple of years. I've been going to Adventist church ever since I was a little kid. And it's not one of those topics that's brought up. I think because of the discomfort of bringing in sort of political tinged, yeah, you know, topic into church.
Yeah. I've been trying to rack my brain thinking about times churches have talked about it. And I think it was brought up in religion class only in connection with Desmond Doss, the guy, the conscientious objector.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's the only time it was brought up. And I find it interesting that this is I think that this is a real spiritual discussion.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a wide variety of understanding of where you can land within, yeah, that discussion. And at the same time, it's a discussion that's kept at a very, very long distance from where the church is, because I think you're right. I think there's a fear of being divisive or being perceived as political, mm-hmm, in a church that doesn't want to be political.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's just one denomination or another. I think it seems to be pretty common within American Christianity.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, Alex, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh,
I appreciate
it.
I feel like I learned a lot, and I appreciate just you being willing to talk about your life and where you've come from and all that and stuff. And we hope to have you again here on the Paradox Podcast.
Yeah, I hope it was helpful for all the listeners.
Yep. Well, thanks so much for listening. And for Alex, we hope that you guys have a great rest of your week. And we'll see you guys next time when we produce another podcast. Take care.